This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks on KQV with expert advice from CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang, the best-selling author of Retire Secure and The Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once and Never Again. Now on the air and online worldwide at paytaxeslater.com, get ready to talk smart money.
Oh, and welcome to today's edition of the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. I'm David Baer here in the KQV studio with Jim Lang, CPA, attorney, and author of three books, Retire Secure, The Roth Revolution, and now Retire Secure for Same-Sex Couples. We're going to change our regular format a bit today in light of historic and late-breaking headlines regarding same-sex marriage in Pennsylvania. That's right. As KQV listeners heard early today when Jim Lang spoke with Earl Bugel on the live line, now that Pennsylvania's ban on same-sex marriage has been declared unconstitutional, committed LGBT couples can take advantage of many previously denied benefits to cut their taxes and increase their wealth by hundreds of dollars. Jim?
Well, first, why don't we talk about two aspects of the decision that came down. The first are the legal aspects. So basically, there's two areas. One is that Pennsylvania will now recognize same-sex couples' marriage in different states. So
From states.
So let's say, for example, that a same-sex couple was married in New York or Washington, D.C. or California or Massachusetts or any of the before 16 states that did recognize same-sex marriages. Up to now, Pennsylvania did not recognize those marriages.
Mm-hmm.
That's one aspect of the decision that has changed. The second aspect of the decision is that now same-sex couples can get married in Pennsylvania. And actually, I think there's at least hundreds, maybe thousands of people who have applied for marriage licenses literally within the last 24 hours. So there is a hotbed of activity for same-sex couples who can now get legally married in Pennsylvania.
Can that decision be appealed?
Well, we thought it might be. On the other hand, today, Governor Corbett came out and said it would not be appealed. Now, that would not be his personal choice. He would like to see it appealed in reverse, but I think that realistically, he sensed that he was likely to lose. It might have been political. It might have been, for whatever reason, they decided not to appeal it. So basically, the decision was issued without a stay, meaning it was effective the day it was made, which was May 20th. So as of the minute it was made, people could apply for licenses. And now that Governor Corbett has said that he will not appeal, I don't think that people have to fear that the law will be reversed.
Well, I know that you're a legal expert, but even more than that, could you tell our listeners about some of the practical financial impacts of the decision on committed same-sex couples?
All right, well, here we have to, it's not as big as some people might think, and the reason is because of prior laws that were the federal laws in nature. So why don't we take a quick history? So the big law that really changed the whole argument is a case called Windsor, which was actually a federal Supreme Court case. And Windsor was actually an estate tax case. So if you are married and your beneficiary is a U.S. citizen, there is something called an unlimited marital deduction. So you could have $1 billion, $100 million, it doesn't matter how much. And if you leave that money to your spouse, there is no federal estate tax. Now, in Windsor, New York State did recognize the marriage of two women. But for federal estate tax purposes, under DOMA, which basically said that the federal government would not recognize same-sex marriages, the federal exemption or the unlimited marital deduction was denied. She was required to pay estate tax. She appealed. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, hey, not only are we going to recognize same-sex marriages if the state recognizes same-sex marriages, but we are going to use the law of celebration, not the law of residence, to control.
The state of celebration.
That's correct. So the law of the state of the celebration. So if you got married in New York or Massachusetts or California or any of the then 16 states, for federal estate tax purposes, you were deemed married. And even if you were a resident of Pennsylvania, you were still deemed married. Now, that was very important for precedent, but if you think about what the financial implications for same-sex couples are, they were not all that big for most same-sex couples, because even without that law, everybody, whether you're married or unmarried or anything else, has what is today a $5.3 million exemption from federal estate tax. And if you're married, you have a $10.6 million. But even if you're just single, you have a 5.3. Well, most people don't have 5.3 million. So as a practical matter, for most taxpayers, Windsor wasn't all that important, even though it's cited all the time.
And but there's a state inherent, a state tax to it on top of that, isn't it?
Well, we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
I'm not there yet. So then the IRS came down with revenue ruling 2013-17. And that was where the IRS said, hey, we are going to extend the Windsor decision to income taxes. So now, no matter where you live, if you got married in a state that recognized same-sex marriage, for federal income tax purposes, you were going to be considered married. Now, this affected a lot of people because, you know, virtually everybody pays income taxes. And there are, particularly in the area of estate planning for IRAs and retirement plans, there are enormous benefits of inheriting IRAs and retirement plans from a spouse versus inheriting IRAs and retirement plans from a partner. So for that reason, and for reasons that we're about to talk to in a couple minutes regarding Social Security, my advice to a lot of same-sex couples was go to a place like Washington, D.C., get married, come back to Pennsylvania to live, and if one of you die, the survivor will be significantly better off, not because of estate tax purposes, although if you have more than $5.3 million, it would be important for federal estate tax purposes, but for income tax purposes. And since, you know, most everybody, at least the people that I work with, have some kind of IRA or 401k or 403b or some type of retirement plan, and since the rules that I'm not going to get into the details, but I do certainly in the book Retire Secure for Same-Sex Couples, are so much more favorable for spouses than for non-spouses, I was saying go get married, come back to Pennsylvania, and then if the member of the couple who has the IRA or retirement plan dies, it will save tens, maybe hundreds, maybe over $1 million for the survivor.
Okay, I can see that. And well, and so now in Pennsylvania,
that was the deal before the Whitehead decision. All right, so now Pennsylvania says, hey, we are now going to recognize same-sex marriage. Now, a couple things on that. First is, like you had mentioned earlier, PA inheritance tax. Before, a couple days ago, the PA inheritance tax, whether it's one spouse to another or one partner to another, it was still a 15% PA inheritance tax. Now, if you are married, there is no PA inheritance tax. So let's say you had an estate of $1 million and you left it to your spouse. Before, $150,000 tax. Today, no tax. Excuse me. So that's one aspect. Now, let's talk about while people are living. And this is huge. And this, by the way, to me, if you're a same-sex couple, and particularly if you're in your 60s or older, you're even considering getting married, the Whitehead decision now gives you much more motivation to get married, and here's why. Because now, I said before that the federal government and the IRS would treat you married if you got married in a place that recognized same-sex marriage, and that was basically the state of celebration, not the state of residence. But for purposes of Social Security and collecting spousal benefits for Social Security, which over time can be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, that was controlled by the state of residence. So before, a Pennsylvania resident was not entitled to spousal benefits for Social Security, whether they were married or not, and if they were married, it didn't matter where they were married. Now, under the new law, which is not going to be appealed, they will be entitled to spousal benefits. There's not going to be an appeal. So now there's a lot of people in their 60s that should be considering getting married because they will have all the benefits of a spousal benefit for Social Security, which, again, we could do a whole show on. In fact, we've actually done four of them, not in the same-sex context, but actually in the married context. And you can use such techniques as apply and suspend. You can do claim now, claim more later. You can have just plain spousal benefits. And then you can also have spousal death benefits, which can be literally hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it was a big deal for Pennsylvania residents, not just from a civil rights standpoint, but also from a financial standpoint.
Well, you know, it's all that's interesting, and I think now we should take a quick break and listeners can hear about how they can find out more about this.
This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring expert advice from CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang. More coming up right here on KQB.
You're listening to a pre-recorded encore presentation of the Lang Money Hour with CPA and attorney James Lang. Please do not call. If you should have any questions or like more information regarding the topics discussed, please call Lang Financial Group at 412-521-2732 or go online to retiresecure.com.
KQV listeners, with the historic May 20 ruling by federal judge John Jones declaring Pennsylvania's ban on same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional, committed LGBT couples in the Keystone State can now take advantage of many benefits previously denied to them. Lang Financial Group has been creating opportunities for same-sex couples and their families for over a decade. On Saturday, May 31st, Jim Lang will conduct a free same-sex couple retirement and estate planning workshop at the Wyndham Pittsburgh University Center in Oakland. The morning session, from 9:30 to 11:30, is titled New Estate Planning Strategies for Same-Sex Couples with IRAs and Retirement Plans, and Who Says You Can't Control from the Grave? How Same-Sex Couples Can Use Trust to Protect Themselves and Their Families. From 1 to 3 p.m., Jim's topic will be The Demise of DOMA, New Financial Planning Strategies for Pennsylvania Same-Sex Couples. At 3:15, Jim will offer a 30-minute briefing, What's a Better Investment Strategy, Active Investing or Passive Investing with Index Funds? He'll show why, with 86% of active asset managers underperforming the market, you're likely better off with an optimized portfolio of index funds. Workshop attendees can take one, two, or all three sessions, and spouses are encouraged to attend. They'll also get a free copy of Jim's brand new book, Retire Secure for Same-Sex Couples, and the offer of a no-cost follow-up meeting. Light refreshments will be served. There's no charge for the Saturday, May 31st workshop at the Wyndham Pittsburgh University Center in Oakland, but space is limited. To reserve your place, call the Lang Financial Group at 412-521-2732. That's 521-2732. For more information, visit the website outestateplanning.com. That's outestateplanning.com.
The Lang Money Hour continues on KQB AM 1410. For all your financial needs, turn to the Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill. For more information, visit online at paytaxeslater.com. Let's talk more smart money.
And welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. I'm David Baer here in the KQV studio with Jim Lang. One aspect of estate planning is making the decisions that will lead to a secure retirement, but it also entails reevaluating those decisions as your life circumstances and situations change. For insights on this issue, we welcome Julie Jason back to the show. Longtime Director of Personal Money Management for Jackson Grant Investment Advisors, she's a strong proponent of financial literacy who approaches investing with a healthy skepticism. author of 6 books, including the AARP Retirement Survival Guide, How to Make Smart Financial Decisions in Good Times and Bad. Julie's been quoted widely for her views on retirement and investing, and the IRS recognized her weekly financial column for its accurate, timely, informative, and helpful tax information. So, without further ado, welcome Julie.
Hi, hello, how are you?
Good, it's great to have you back on the show, Julie.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, one of the things that I think a lot of our listeners are interested in is as they approach retirement, they are interested in, can they afford to retire? How much money can they spend in retirement? And I know that you actually write about this and you do this in practice. So I thought I would go right to the source and say, how do you do those calculations? Do you get into discussions of safe withdrawal rate? What do you do when somebody is either thinking about retirement or they've already retired? The biggest issue is they never want to run out of money during their lifetime. What kind of advice would you have for somebody in that situation?
Yeah, so the real question is, will your money last as long as you do? And, of course, you have to go through an analysis on a case-by-case basis, on a person-by-person basis. I do not believe there is such a thing as a safe withdrawal rate that applies to every single person. I just don't believe it. I think this is a very, very personal exercise. And if you just think about it, you know, if you have relatives or friends who are the same age, are they in the same circumstances as you are? Do they have the same lifestyle as you do? Do they have the same investment knowledge that you do? Do they have the same investment expertise or experience that you do? And you know that the answer is no, they don't. And that's always the starting point. So I think many times you'll see publications writers and experts come out with a number. They'll say either 3 or 4% or some other number. But I think that's folly. I think that it really depends on your situation. But let me tell you something that I find interesting. When I was writing the AARP book, which was in 2006-2007, one of the statistics that I researched for the book was what were people saying was a safe withdrawal rate. And I have my notes from that period of time, and I found this very interesting. This is a 2006 survey, so it was before the financial crisis. Do you know that individuals who were surveyed, some of them believed that they could withdraw as much as 21% annually from their retirement savings without running out of money? How do you like that?
Well, that's pretty shocking.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now,
how did they figure that?
They didn't.
You have to wonder. But there was another statistic which surveyed advisors, and that was also in 2006. And the range of expectations of a safe withdrawal rate given by advisors was between 3 to 11% as a safe withdrawal rate that you could reasonably expect you would not run out of money. So the reason I'm pointing that out is that it is absolute folly to come up with a percentage, and it will be market dependent. You know, that number will be bigger or lower based on where you are in the market. So I think for people who are approaching retirement or in retirement, or even millennials who are thinking that there has to be another way other than possibly Social Security or a pension, they really have to focus on themselves, learn how to invest, learn about the markets, and learn about what is safe for them, which is tied to health and longevity and lifestyle. And it's really, really, really all about you, the investor. It's not about some artificial number or someone else's situation.
So basically, you're going to answer like an attorney. It depends. But I actually think that
you don't mean that meanly, do you?
Since I am an attorney, I'm allowed to knock attorneys. Are there some guidelines that you would have? So, for example, I'd like to hear the guidelines because I know that you're just not going to. I mean, I've read your stuff, and you don't just say, "Well, it depends." Bye.
Right. Well, okay. Let me tell you the guidelines. So, the first thing that I do when I meet a client is I assess what they've been doing in the past. So what kind of investors are they? So that's key. Are they aggressive investors or conservative investors? What are they used to doing? So that determines if you can, if you just think about it, if you are thinking in terms of a withdrawal rate, well, it depends on the investments. How are the investments structured? What is safe for that type of structuring? So experience and understanding is key. Now, they're coming to us for our experience, so we will apply our experience to their situation, but I always want to know where they're coming from. So that's one thing. The second thing is we need to have a sense of longevity. So, you know, we need to know if we're talking to someone who's 40, they may be retired, 50, 60, 70, 80. The age does, longevity is an issue. So we want to be able to have a sense of longevity. There might be something that is family specific that we need to know, but longevity. So those two things right there are pointing back at the client. Now, the third thing is cash flows. So we want to know what's the lifestyle look like and how much does it cost to live today. We're not projecting anything out into the future yet. Those are the three elements that are the starting points. And then what are the plans for the future? So expanding lifestyle, contracting lifestyle, all the things that go to a cash flow analysis. So those four elements all focus on the client, and it truly is all about you. It's not about someone you know. It's not about someone external to you or someone outside of your family. So that's the basis of the analysis. And then you look at assets. So what are the assets, and how does the cash flow picture fit in to what the asset level is? And the ideal structuring of a portfolio is one that protects the principal and allows the portfolio to spin off interest and dividends that support the lifestyle. So you back into the structure of the portfolio based on the cash flow demands on the portfolio. It is an iterative process, and it sometimes takes some time to work through those elements. But then once you do, then you have your safe withdrawal rate. And it depends on all of those factors as to what that number is. There's no special number for any one particular person. It's a process that's not, it doesn't require any kind of special analysis. It doesn't require, it's not a, you know, you don't have to be brilliant to do this. It's just a process of organizing yourself, organizing the effort, and just working through each element of the puzzle.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed is, and maybe it's the type of clients that I have, who tend to be pretty involved in their careers and usually work a lot of hours, is I don't like, and I know the rule of thumb is to actually assume that you're going to need less income in retirement. And I kind of think that you're going to need at least as much as you have now, maybe more, because one of the reasons you didn't spend as much money, you didn't go on as vacation as often, you didn't develop expensive hobbies, is you were too busy working.
You know, that's a very good point. And again, it points to how individualized this study is. Because, yes, one person will want to expand his lifestyle. Another person will want to contract his lifestyle. So it really is individualized. But, yeah, you're making a good point. It's not the same for everybody.
And the other thing, I have clients that come in and say, hey, you know, I'm 65 years old. I'm in very good health. You know, I know in 10 or 15 years it's not going to be this way. I'm not going to be able to travel as much. I'm not going to be able to engage in some of these activities. So therefore, I want to spend more now. And hang on a second. Isn't the potential cost for increased health care, in effect, overriding or at least equaling the additional money that you want to spend now? So I don't like when clients say, okay, I want to spend a lot of money now because I'll plan to live more frugally, or I won't have the needs in later
completely
in life.
Completely agree, because the uncontrollable costs are health costs, et cetera. And then, of course, you have to factor in inflation. So we've been living in a low inflationary environment, but, you know, and people aren't talking too much about inflation. But I have some figures here for if you look at a lifelong career and you look at saving during a lifelong career for preparing for retirement. You look at 40 years. So I just looked at a 40-year rolling period going back to the 20s. And I'll tell you, the inflation numbers are pretty high. The last 40 years, so starting 74 through the end of 2013, on an inflation-adjusted basis, the S&P 500 returned about 7% annually during that period, and the average annual inflation rate during that period was 4.13%. That's much higher than people realize. You know, many people talk about the Ibbotson number, the 3% average annual inflation number since 1926 through today. That's an annual number, but once you start looking at chunks of long periods like 40 years, they get pretty big. Those numbers get pretty big.
And that's also depending on how you define inflation. So I know, for example, during high periods of inflation, that in order not to fuel more inflation, there was motivation for the government to show that inflation wasn't so bad. So they didn't take into account the cost of fuel and the cost of food into inflation. So yes, the cost of your computers might go down, but when you go to the gas, the gas tank, or when you go to the grocery store, all of a sudden your expenses were way up. So your 4.1% number actually might be low. So I think you're right.
And that is high. You know, at 4% is a very high number. But yeah, you're making a very good point. During those high inflationary times, remember when we had the gas lines? So 1979, inflation averaged 13.3% for that year, 12.5% in 1980, 8.9% in 1981, before declining to 3.8% in 1982. We have to be prepared for inflation. And that brings us to talking about the market. If you look at what the choices are in terms of investment options, when you're considering have an overlay of inflation, you have to look at the stock market, because when people run to the safety of a bank or treasury bills when they're concerned about volatility, that is not going to be good enough during an inflationary period. So the banks and the T-bills lose money during normal inflationary times. They don't allow you to build capital. So it's really a question of looking to the stock market to build wealth, build retirement wealth, and then maintain wealth during retirement as well.
So if you're taking into account inflation and you're taking into account that perhaps some of your expenses might be higher, like fuel and food, and maybe sometimes some of those numbers like 4% or even I've seen higher might be a little bit too high if you actually look at individual circumstances.
Yeah. So what that paints a picture that takes the potential retiree or the retiree to the following point. The point is that it's very important to do a little bit of homework when you're transitioning into retirement, and it's the kind of homework that you have to sit down and you have to start doing some planning, and that some people don't want to do the planning, and this is where you need help. You know, because it's not, like I said, it's not, you don't have to be brilliant to do it, but you just have to be organized and go through an organized effort to take a look at all the elements and come up with a program, a plan that will serve you for the rest of your life. And it's those transitional periods, the retirement, the death of a spouse, a divorce, the sale of a business, an inheritance, those are the key times when you really need to sit down and plan.
Well, and I think that it can't be overestimated the importance of the potential death of a spouse. So, for example, particularly, I don't know why I've seen a number of them in the past couple of weeks where a husband and wife came in and the husband had a pension that might have been, a reasonable pension, maybe $5,000-$6,000 a month. And I always ask, well, what happens to the pension if you die? And I always hope for, oh, well, my wife gets 100% of the benefit. But often it's not. Often it's, 50% or sometimes even less. And I had one case where, we took the whole amount, that is a one-life pension, and we made up for it by buying a $100,000 life insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, maybe that's, by the way, those numbers have never worked for me, but if they did, it might be closer to a $500,000 policy. So I think a lot of times you underestimate what you might lose in pension. And the other thing is, yes, it is true that in general, the surviving spouse will get the higher of the two Social Securities, but the surviving spouse will only get one Social Security. They won't get both like you did while you were both alive.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that has to be taken into account.
Absolutely. And these are the types of things that, again, they're, you know, anyone can do it as long as they put in the effort, put in the time, and it is so important to do. Because if you think about it, when you're 30, you can pretty much buy just about any kind of stock or stock mutual fund with the help of either doing research or with the help of financial expertise. But it's very different when you are trying to turn over your investments into a portfolio that will do not only produce income for you now for today, but also produce income for you for the rest of your life, offset inflation, offset taxes, offset rising costs if there are rising costs. That's a very different exercise.
Well, I think those are some good words of wisdom. The other thing, and I think that you're just being nice about it, is that you keep saying you have to do this because you don't want to push people going to a financial advisor or getting some help. But very frankly, I see some people who are pretty bright, and if I'm going to pick on one class of people, might as well pick on the engineers, because they probably have the highest degree of smarts compared to thinking how smart they are, meaning that they think they're very smart, and they might be in very many areas, but in some areas, and sometimes some long-term financial planning, they are terribly mistaken. And sometimes even just talking with the appropriate financial professional might make a huge difference.
Well, that's interesting.
In their plans.
Interesting observation.
By the way, I'm married to
a
software engenieer, and I have a lot of engineers as clients. So I think quantitatively myself, and
yeah.
I like engineers, but sometimes, a lot of times, engineers think they know a lot about everything, including financial planning, and they
yeah.
might know more than the average person. They might get it a little better, but they often, on their own, don't come to the best conclusions.
Yeah, that's interesting. Interesting observation. But I'm a big fan of really learning as much as possible, and also being, you know, if you're working with someone, then to really understand what's going on, to ask questions, understand pricing, understand skill, understand expertise. I recently had a situation where I was talking to an individual who was planning on how to choose an advisor, and he had just gone to a presentation at headquarters for one of the major firms, and I asked him about the person that he was speaking with, and he had 4 years of experience, and he was actually thinking of possibly using that individual. Now, that is not too smart. You know, you really have to have someone who's got experience in this particular field.
Maybe we'll talk about how to pick the appropriate person after we come back.
Yeah, we should take another break now, so let's do that.
This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring expert advice from CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang. More coming up right here on KQB.
KQV listeners, with the historic May 20 ruling by federal judge John Jones declaring Pennsylvania's ban on same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional, committed LGBT couples in the Keystone State can now take advantage of many benefits previously denied to them. Lang Financial Group has been creating opportunities for same-sex couples and their families for over a decade. On Saturday, May 31st, Jim Lang will conduct a free same-sex couple retirement and estate planning workshop at the Wyndham Pittsburgh University Center in Oakland. The morning session, from 9:30 to 11:30, is titled New Estate Planning Strategies for Same-Sex Couples with IRAs and Retirement Plans, and Who Says You Can't Control from the Grave? How Same-Sex Couples Can Use Trust to Protect Themselves and Their Families. From 1 to 3 p.m., Jim's topic will be The Demise of DOMA, New Financial Planning Strategies for Pennsylvania Same-Sex Couples. At 3:15, Jim will offer a 30-minute briefing. What's a better investment strategy, active investing or passive investing with index funds? He'll show why, with 86% of active asset managers underperforming the market, you're likely better off with an optimized portfolio of index funds. Workshop attendees can take one, two, or all three sessions, and spouses are encouraged to attend. They'll also get a free copy of Jim's brand new book, Retire Secure for Same-Sex Couples, and the offer of a no-cost follow-up meeting. Light refreshments will be served. There's no charge for the Saturday, May 31st workshop at the Wyndham Pittsburgh University Center in Oakland, but space is limited. To reserve your place, call the Lang Financial Group at 412-521-2732. That's 521-2732. For more information, visit the website outestateplanning.com. That's outestateplanning.com.
You're listening to a pre-recorded encore presentation of the Lang Money Hour with CPA and attorney James Lang. Please do not call. If you should have any questions or like more information regarding the topics discussed, please call Lang Financial Group at 412-521-2732 or go online to retiresecure.com.
The Lang Money Hour continues on KQB AM 1410. For all your financial needs, turn to the Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill. For more information, visit online at paytaxeslater.com. Let's talk more smart money.
And welcome back to the Lang Money Hour with Julie Jason and Jim Lang.
So, Julie, you were starting to talk about some of the criteria that you think consumers should use in deciding who to go to for financial help. And the one thing that you did say is you didn't like the idea of somebody putting their life savings into someone who has 4 years experience in the field.
Yeah, because you know, you really, this is not a time to train someone with your money. You know, you really need to go to someone who is well versed in how the markets work and how investments work, and most importantly, well versed in how to work with individuals who are approaching or in retirement. It is a very, very different situation to sell a stock or a bond to an individual who's, again, much younger, and turn lifetime savings into a retirement portfolio. Two completely different experience levels are needed for that. And plus, you want someone who's lived through different markets, because you have to understand how markets work, and that's not something that you can pick up during a training program.
Okay, so let's say that somebody says, okay, that makes sense. You know, I should go to somebody that has at least 10, maybe better yet, 20 or even 30, because I have more than 30, so I'll just throw that in there, years of experience. What other criteria should they use? Because there's certainly a lot of not so good advisors that do have 20 or 30 years experience.
All right. So again, if you're, it depends on what you're looking for. So if you're looking for someone who can specifically know enough and be experienced enough to help structure a retirement portfolio and run it so that you don't run out of money for the rest of your life, you need to look for that expertise in particular. So you have to interview people to see what they do and what they do most of the time, not what they do 5% of the time. And that's a journey. It's a search, and it's a search, the kind of search that you would do when you're hiring someone. So it's exactly the same sort of thing. So you're looking for someone who will work with you and work with you well and produce the results that you need.
All right, so you basically are saying do your due diligence in choosing an advisor, because it's an important decision.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, there's no question.
All right. And what about the way the advisor is paid? Do you think it is a good idea to demand to know how exactly the advisor is compensated?
Absolutely, because that determines that's very relevant to a whole bunch of different things. And one thing... you know, it's interesting. The SEC has done a number of surveys, and the CFA Society has done a number of surveys of whether people understand the differences between advisors. And I'm looking at a survey right now in front of me. There's quite a bit of work that's been done in the field. This is published by the Securities and Exchange Commission in January of 2011, and it's a study on investment advisors and broker-dealers. If anyone in your audience is interested in understanding the true differences, I would highly recommend that they pull out this 200-page study and take a look at it, because it goes through surveys and it goes through the legal standards that apply to different types of people who are financial advisors. And what it concludes is that the investor really doesn't know the differences, and there's a reason. The reason is that the industry, financial services industry, uses the same terminology to describe people in the industry. So a financial advisor, financial consultant, money managers, a financial planner, there are many different terms, or senior executive of investments, those terms are loosely used, so you can't tell by the title, so you have to go deeper. And fiduciary duty, well, you know, the SEC has concluded that people do not know what that means.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because I think that's critical, and I know that you have written how critical that is. So can you tell us the difference between a fiduciary advisor, which, by the way, I happen to be one of, and someone who is not a fiduciary advisor?
Yeah, so it's... If you approach it from the legal standard, you'll get confused. So let me approach it from a practical standard. From a practical point of view, the person who is held to a fiduciary duty, that's the highest duty under the law, must disclose conflicts of interest, if there are any conflicts of interest, and also put your interest ahead of his. So those are the two things that are most important, and there are a number of lawsuits there are a couple of court cases that go through the standards of care. And by the way, if anyone would like a copy of that, let me know, because I'm happy to email anyone any of that material. So that's the fiduciary, that's the highest standard. You can really tell the difference by looking at the lower standard. Under the lower standard, there is no duty to disclose fees or conflicts of interest. So, and there's no duty to put the client ahead of, if you're the financial advisor, no duty to put the client ahead of your own interest. Now, so it's a caveat emptor standard, buyer beware standard. So, you know, if you as a consumer don't realize that, you think everyone has the duty to disclose conflicts, then you are at a potential disadvantage. But the way you solve that is you have to ask questions. So you have to ask, how much? How are you regulated? What else have you considered for me, and why are you showing me this recommendation? So it's a series of possibly embarrassing questions, but they must be asked.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I would say that I think most people need help in two areas. One is the areas that I like to write about and talk about on the radio and do, which is mainly strategies. Roth IRA conversions, Social Security, tax planning, tax loss harvesting, how much money people can safely spend, should you set up a 529 plan for your grandchildren, what the estate planning type is. And that's what I personally like to do. And then there's the other issue, which is actually managing the money, which is what you're talking about now. In my office, for example, by the way, to me it's too overwhelming for not only me to do all those functions, but even to have my office do those functions. So we have an arrangement whereby we have a money manager who we think is a very good money manager doing a lot of the kind of things that you're talking about, who uses low-cost index funds. Then our office runs the numbers and does the Roth stuff and the Social Security and the tax, et cetera. And then together we charge 1% or less, and we're both fiduciaries. But I think that your point of somebody who's going to really do the planning for you, and how are they going to charge you, and are they true fiduciaries, are very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So you have. It sounds like you've thought through how to combine the best of both worlds to have an independent person who's doing the money management, and then have you do the other side of the planning.
Well, partly it's personal because I didn't come from a sales background. I came from a CPA and legal background, mm-hmm. and I love these strategy parts. And my advice when I got into money management was, well, if you don't do it, just hire somebody. But the way I figured it is, how do I know if I have the right person? Then I'm supervising somebody that I don't know if they're giving the right advice. Then what if it doesn't work out and the person leaves and the client is holding the bag? I actually wanted somebody who was as good in money management as I was in my area. So I think that that's somewhat of a unique model, but hopefully...
Yeah, it actually is. It's very interesting.
Yeah, but hopefully when people are going to somebody that in one form or another, they are getting the benefit of both the tax, Roth, Social Security, tax loss harvesting, estate planning, etc., and the appropriate money management, and whether that comes from one person or one firm or multiple firms. Some people have CPAs and lawyers and financial advisors, and unfortunately sometimes it's confusing because it's you get different pieces of advice.
Well, it seems to be a clear advantage if you get both the long-term perspective and the short-term, you know, analysis that will provide the best overall organic result.
Well, of course, we would say that we're, I don't think Joey or I would like the idea that saying we're just doing short term. I would think that we would hope that we would do all long term. But one of the issues that I think that maybe you could help our listeners out is both you and I are big fans of being a fiduciary advisor. How can you tell if somebody's a fiduciary advisor? You know, if somebody's selling insurance and he doesn't say, oh, by the way, I stand to make money for this, or there's somebody selling an annuity where there's maybe a 10% commission, and they're not disclosing that. How can you find out?
Well, okay, so you have to be a bit of a nudge, and you really have to ask what's the regulatory structure that covers you. But I have to tell you that a lot of advisors don't know how they're regulated, surprisingly. And you know, in my personal experience, there's some confusion as to on that level. But then you also can ask for a form ADV, also called a brochure. So you can go to the SEC website, and so that's the Securities and Exchange Commission website, and look up the firm and look up the form ADV. So the form ADV is a disclosure document, and every fiduciary advisor must comply with the registration requirements unless there's an exception. There are some exceptions for lawyers and accountants. And so that's a very good starting point. Now, I have to mention that you have some firms that are both fiduciaries and non-fiduciaries. And this happened after there was a very interesting case that was decided in 2006, 2007, the District Court of the District of, I'm sorry, the Circuit Court of the District of Columbia, called Financial Planning Association versus SEC. And until that time, if you bought a managed account, which looks like it's a fiduciary type of account, from a major brokerage firm, there had to be a disclosure on that form, on the paperwork. And just let me just give you a minute. Let me just read this disclosure to you, and then you'll get I think your audience might get a sense of what it means to be a, you know, what the difference is. So very quickly, what the disclosure had to say is, your account is a brokerage account and not an advisory account. Our interests may not always be the same as yours. Please ask us questions to make sure you understand your rights and our obligations to you, including the extent of our obligations to disclose conflicts of interest and to act in your best interest. We are paid both by you and sometimes by people who compensate us based on what you buy, et cetera, et cetera. So,
that's pretty scary.
Isn't that interesting? So that was the disclosure that was required before on marketing literature before this case came down, and the result of the case was that someone who was selling a product like this had to become a registered investment advisor and had to be a fiduciary. But the problem now, and this gets a little complicated, the problem now is you can go to someone who is both a fiduciary and not a fiduciary, and you have to ask, which hat are you wearing? Are you wearing the fiduciary hat or the non-fiduciary hat? And technically, the term is called dual registration. So many firms are now registered both as registered investment advisors, which are the fiduciaries, and the non-fiduciaries that are who are the brokerage firms. So you can go to a major firm and now have one person you're talking to who can wear two hats, and you have to ask, which hat are you wearing?
That's pretty scary. Is it fair enough to say to your advisor, are you a fiduciary, and are you acting in a fiduciary manner with regards to my account?
Yeah, and right now, this advice that you're giving me, are you acting as a fiduciary right now with respect to the advice? Yes, of course.
And
now,
of course,
can you rely on that? You know, so
if you have a recording,
I would hope that somebody wouldn't lie about something like that outright.
Well,
on the other hand, I'm naive because
it could be a misunderstanding too, and that's why when you really want to have something in writing, you know, that confirms your understanding of the situation. So, and one way to do that, and I am an arbitrator and a mediator as well. So, one way to do that is just to write a note to whoever you're dealing with, the financial advisor, and say, I understand that this is whatever the deal is that you're recommending I do, blah, 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 and that you are acting in my best interest when you're making this recommendation, and that there is no hidden or undisclosed conflict of interest in this recommendation. Now, who's going to do that? I don't know. But that would be the way to really safely pursue this course of action.
And for whatever it's worth, in our office, if we even mention investments, I give people my ADV and the ADV of the money manager, and that has all types of information about us, including all our fees, which I think is appropriate. And that way, people know right up front exactly what we're going to do for them and how much they're going to pay.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want to look for.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes left, and I don't know if we have covered everything that you want. And the other thing is, you have so many books out, and you have so many potential things that I could encourage listeners to pick up. If you could tell us what you think might be the most relevant thing for most of our listeners. I loved your AARP books.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I like the book, I forget the name of it, but the one that came out in 2011 I thought was excellent.
So, Managing Retirement Wealth is the title.
Right, all right. So yeah. So that was the one that I read and liked the most.
Thank you.
If there was one book that our buyers or listeners should go to, do you think that it would be that? Or
let me just give you very briefly those two books, the AARP Retirement Survival Guide and Managing Retirement Wealth, are really meant to be read together. And the reason is the AARP book is written for a very broad audience, but it goes through some of the issues that we've been talking about, such as pricing, how do you find an advisor, how do you know who you're talking to, a big section on scams that you don't want to get into, especially as you're retiring, and some transcripts from some cases that show how people are approached incorrectly. Also cash flow, and also there's a big section on on insurance products too, which I think are important to understand as you're moving into retirement, because you may be shown an insurance product, a retirement income product. All right, so that's the AARP book. Then the second book that follows it, Managing Retirement Wealth, takes people who want who have assets, who want to structure a retirement portfolio, and it answers the question of how can you live on it? In other words, will your money last for a lifetime? And then how do you leave a legacy and all? So that's more of a process book that takes you through the process of how do you organize yourself and how do you structure the portfolio. So they really come together, I think, the two of them. And by the way, I do write a column as well, and I encourage people to write to me with their questions, because I'm very happy to answer questions through the column. And
you know something, we really have to go.
Yep.
But the important thing is the books. And let me simplify if I could. Go to Amazon.com, Julie Jason, look for the AARP book, and the other one is called
Managing Retirement Wealth.
Thank you so much. You've been a great guest.
Thank you.
And you can also reach Julie at www.juliejason.com. Thanks also to Phil Stillwagon, our in-studio producer and Lang Financial Group program coordinator, Amanda Cassidy-Swinesburg. As always, you can hear an on-air broadcast of this show at 9:05 this Sunday morning here on KQV and access the audio archive of past programs, including written transcripts on the Lang Financial Group website, paytaxeslater.com. And here's a special offer for one day only, Monday, June 16th, Kindle ebook version of Jim's new book, Retire Secure for Same-Sex Couples, will be available for free on Amazon. Otherwise, all proceeds from the book go to Freedom to Marry, the nation's leading campaign working to end the exclusion of same-sex couples from the responsibilities, protections, and commitment of marriage. You can also call the Lang offices at 412-521-2732. And finally, mark your calendar for Wednesday, June 4th at 7:05 and the next new edition of the Lang Money Hour, when Jim will welcome Pitt Professor of Law Lawrence Froelich to the show.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Check out the show archives and listen on demand anytime at paytaxeslater.com. KQV listeners can receive free tickets to Jim Lang's Pittsburgh area workshops and more. Call the Lang Financial Group at 412-521-2732 and reserve your seats and meet Jim Lang in person or visit paytaxeslater.com. That's paytaxeslater.com.